Let's review the parsha until now and add a little bit, some pointers. Let's note a few things. Avram is told, Lech Lecha, go for your sake, and I'll show you the land. And Avram is showed, he comes to the land of Canaan, which is ultimately going to be known as the land of Israel. This is Avram's first test. Will he leave his family? Will he leave everything he knew before? And we discussed that this is very often the breaking point, whether a person will grow or not. Can he leave his past? And this is in general very often the question as to whether a person will be a major success or not. A person has to leave the comfort zone, meaning what's comfortable, what's secure, also doesn't afford us the greatest ability to expand. When a person wants to grow, it could be in business or anything else, you have to take a certain amount of risk and jump. At some point in life, you have to jump. And God tells Abraham, go. We have to remember these two words, Lech Lecha, because we will encounter them again in next week's parsha. When we encounter them there, we'll have to make comparisons. Does anyone remember where? I'll read the psuk, the pasuk. Let's read. What does it say?
As long as there are no follow up questions, yes, I remember completely.
Is it when he does that?
It says, Vayomer, God tells Avram, Kach na, please take Esbincha, your son, Esyerchidcha, your singular one, Asher Havta, that you loved, Es Yitzchak, Vilech Lecha. The same two words we will encounter next week. Let's think of what the significance of these words are. Okay. Okay.
I guess I'm thinking, it's something I read that, when God tests Abraham or anyone, it's like God already knows that you're. Like God, it's like God only tests you if He knows you're going to pass. But if God already knows you're going to pass the test, why would He test you? He already knows. What does He doesn't prove anything? So it's like to actualize your own potential. You can't meet your own potential until you do it. Even though before you did it, God already knew you'd be able to do it. So maybe it was like God, go for yourself, actualize your potential. So
Natata nes lit noses. Our sages say that's God gives us the opportunity to become a flag, to be uplifted. It has to be shown in the world. We will discuss this at greater length next week, because next week at the Akedah, we will hopefully have time to learn. There's a medrash that says that Avram asks God after the whole Akedah is over, he says, God, why'd you do this to me? Pretty strong question. So next week, well, God willing, discuss that medrash as to our whole understanding of Anisayon. Different opinions. There is in a well-known midrash that the Akedah was his last Nisayon, but again, we'll discuss that in 2 weeks from now. Because going to some understanding, his last Nisayon was burying his wife. So we'll have to discuss why was that his last Nisayon, but that's not for now. Avram starts traveling and he takes his family with him. And here we see that the person who is the symbol of kindness, the Torah stresses that he doesn't do it at the expense of his nephew. He doesn't leave his nephew and say, I got jobs, work to do. He takes his nephew in. The prophet has to warn the Jewish people, Mipsachal titalam. Don't forget your own family. Sometimes a person is so focused on helping the world that they forget their own family. You should know that the Medrash says that Avram's tent had four openings. So whichever direction a person came from, he could enter. Your kids, God willing, will come home from Gan. They're going to come home with a picture of the tent with four entrances. You guys have to know this Medrash. It's a well-known Medrash that Avram's tent had an entrance on each side so that when a guest came, he wouldn't think, how do I get into this place? He'd always find the door. He could always come in.
Good.
I don't know where to say it. I don't know. I think it's a medrash. I don't know. If you have a place in the text that infers it, I'd be happy to see. I don't know, but it could be it does. Okay. I don't know.
Doesn't the text just say he had his tent open? I don't think it says he had it open on all four sides.
I don't know. Show me. It's a well-known medrash. It's known, like kids learn this at when they're 2 years old. My son, I expect to come home with a picture of it. So, I mean, this author probably knew it. Friday comes home with his partial pictures. Yeah.
Are notorious for having a special kind of what do you call it? Sorry, can't think right now. Word. Modesty. Where the Israeli camps that none of them faced each other, none of the tents faced each other. That was one thing that was natural.
Well, it's interesting that you're right. One of the signs of modesty of the Jewish people is that one would not have his opening facing someone else's opening, so they didn't see into one another's tents. It seems from the Psukim that Sarai had a separate tent. So you ask yourself, what's going on? How come she has a separate tent? So one understanding is that we have a halacha that says that a person who's a guest, he isn't with his wife. They don't have relations when they are guests at other people's place, because it's immodest. The other person might be able to see the stains on the blanket or other things. But that's one understanding that's brought here. Another thing that we know is that in ancient times, when a woman had her period, she went to her own tent. She was alone. And this the Ramban brings, that they were so careful, as we will see in 4 weeks from now, that they didn't even step on the earth that a woman who was having her period stepped on. They considered everything so defiled. That's why a woman who has her period, we call her a nida. The root of the word nida is nidui, ostracized, because in ancient times, before the Torah was given, what was accepted is that the woman during this period was like ostracized. She was in her own camp. What we do notice is that Avram is a gentleman. When he comes to camp, he first pitches tent for Sarai. He pitches her tent first. Huh? There's a famine and Avram travels, and we discussed the different understandings as to why he traveled. Avram. Av la'aram. He's the father, he's so to speak the leader of the Armenians. Sarai, my master. She was the people of Aram. Maybe they were Armenians, maybe not, I don't know. Sarai, my master. We have two people. We have his servant, Eli Ezer. My God, my strength, is my helper. That servant is the son or grandson of Nimrod. There was an infamous king who tried to kill him named Nimrod. His arch enemy in the world, also known as Amraphel. One Medrash says that Eliezer was his son. Converted. Switched sides. Came to Avram's side. Another Medrash says that he was a giant. That helps us understand how Avram can take on four kings. He's got this giant helper, Eliezer, on his side.
Nimrod is supposed to be Shem's son.
Nimrod?
Yeah. Or Hamza? No.
Because I remember reading that
Melchizedek,
he wasn't mad when Melchizedek
was killed. Oh, yeah. He killed his offsprings.
But Nimrod himself.
Which would be Nimrod?
It was among the men, it says.
According to his brother, the king, Malaeser, whatever his name is, he was actually Nimrod.
Amraphel was Nimrod.
No.
No? Okay, I think that's what it says.
Malchizedek
was Shem.
No, it was
Shem was alive when Avram was alive?
Shem was Avram when Avram was alive, correct. Shem's daughter was Tamar, who was married to Avram's grandson named Yehuda. Great grandson. What?
What?
Didn't follow, huh?
In the Midrash, he said that.
It says like this. Cham was Noach's son, right? Cham had a son by the name of Cush, and Cush had a son by the name of Nimrod. Nimrod was Cham's grandson, Noach's great-grandson. But he was Cham's grandson, not from Shem. Okay? That's the Psukim. You can look it up. Bereishis chapter 10, verse 6 through 9.
Okay, then one of the kings, then it wasn't Nimrod, but one of the other kings was Shem's son.
Shem's offsprings were among the people who were killed. But let's get to that. We haven't gotten there yet. We're skipping ahead. So, Avram's traveling. He asks his wife to say she's his sister. She is really his niece. She's his brother's daughter. And that's why later he can justify that. The woman is taken forcibly. Avram tells her, look, we're keeping the Torah. We're living like the way the Torah wants. But really, we're only obligated to keep Sheva Mitzvos Pnei Noach. And according to the seven Noahide laws, it says, V'davak be'ishto, one should marry and cling to his wife. So there's a discussion. May one divorce? May one who's keeping the Noahide laws divorce? Does the concept of divorce exist for someone other than a Jew? The Torah teaches us there's a concept of divorce. But someone who doesn't have the Torah, can he divorce? So it seems like, according to the Noahide laws, one may divorce. Not only may one divorce, but one is not obligated to divorce with the legal, with a get, with the things that are legally required by the Jewish court. Meaning, just like going to the Noahide laws, how do you get married? You say, hey, you want to hitch up? Okay, we got together. You and me, we're married. 3 days later, one of you decides, I've had it. So that's it. That's the divorce for a non-Jew. According to Noahide laws. There is a status of marriage. If someone else takes her during the time that they agree that they are married, then he's chayav misa. If someone else takes her during that time, if there is adultery.
So it's part because of their agreement.
Right. But we see
because
also.
Not because of any like status, like legal.
They get that legal status based upon their agreement. Now, obviously, I'm giving one opinion on the matter. Meaning, we're not going into all the depths. There are two Yerushalmis that discuss what we're discussing now. I'm quoting without going into all the details of what I'm quoting. You want, you could see part, what I'm quoting now is from Aktav HaKabbalah. What I quoted before is from the Chemda on Parshas Shmos about Noahide's divorce and not divorce. I'm not going into all the sources now because it's not relevant.
It's just very interesting because of we have let's hand this here, Rabbi, or
no,
it seems to be attacking the promiscuity in the non-Jewish world where there is no marriage.
Because it's improper. No,
so the concept of marriage is completely different.
The concept of marriage is different, and that you could see in the Rambam in the beginning of Hilchos Ishus. And the concept of divorce is in the Rambam, I think, Perik Yud of Hilchos Melachim. But it's also Yerushalmi. But let's leave that. What difference does it make, the sources? I mean, we're not learning the sources anyways. You're not going to open up the books now. We're quoting the sources. So the Noahides, really, we see a certain element of equality where, according to the Noahide laws, the second the woman wants this marriage to be nullified, she has as much power as the man for someone who's not Jewish. Now, Avram tells Sarah, he tells her, I don't know what's going to happen. You might be abducted and I won't know what's happening. So, imni na'achotia, I want you to decide in your own mind that you are my sister. We're friends. We're companions. But we're not married. We're married today. But should it come to be that you are abducted, then imi na'achotia, do me a favor. Don't put yourself, don't put them into a situation where they're doing something they'll be chayav misa for. Don't put yourself into a situation where you're in a problematic situation. Annul the marriage. You have the power just like I do. So Imri no achotia, treat it like you're my sister, like you're my friend. The term ach means to put together. We're accustomed to the word ach being friend. There's a concept in halacha, kira'im, tears, she'inam mitachim, that cannot be reunited. When you unite two things, that's called ichui, putting it together. Yes, Ari.
So what you're saying is, maybe it seems like you're saying that Abraham is telling Sarai, he's still Sarai at this point, that you should consider us as siblings, so that if Paro comes to have his play with you, don't worry, he won't be high of Mita. Sarai is thinking probably, thank you very much, Abraham. I would prefer that he would be high of Mita in this play, you know,
on a simple level we could answer that when a person is on level of Avram and Sarai and all they want is to serve Hashem, they also don't want other people to sin, even if those other people want to sin. There's a famous story that there was once a court case and the Chafetz Chaim was called to the case, and the lawyer said to the judge, he said, I want you to know who's about to testify before you. This is a man that someone was once stealing from his tree, and he chased after the person and he said, Hefker, I don't want you to have transgressed. It's all free. Take it. Take it. So the judge calls the lawyer over and he says, sir, honestly, do you believe that story? So the lawyer said, I'll tell you the truth. I don't know if it's true. I don't know if it's a lie. But one thing I can tell you about me and you, they don't sell such stories. So when we think about the Chafetz Chaim in those days, who his sole concern was that even someone who's stealing from him shouldn't be Hefger. So Avram, who's so much greater, I don't think it's so far-fetched to say that he didn't want them to sin as well as Sarai. There are more answers, which if we were dealing with the general sugya of what really happened halachically had Paro gotten his way, we could go into, but that's not for now. It's too complex. Just a second. Ari, yeah. Yosef.
Wow.
What a compliment. What a compliment. Yeah.
Doesn't it seem inconsistent with the fact that we see that Abraham, here it seems that they recognize that they are on the status of a non-Jew with the king of the Lord. But you see, they kept many other laws that Jews used to keep.
Oh, so Avram was saying, that's what we began with. Avram was telling Sarai, until now we kept everything like Jews. We keep all the Torah. On this point, we're in a situation where it's a tight situation, so let's revert to what we're really obligated to. We'll go like the Noahites. That's what Avram was telling. What?
It's strange.
No, I think the other way around. The other way around. Sometimes a person has to know that when he's doing something that he's not obligated to do, he's living way above the standard. So you don't do that at the expense of other things. A person says, I don't eat anything that's not Chalav Yisrael. I only eat the top Hechsherim. I take on 100 different stringencies. So we say that's very nice. But what happens when you're invited to someone else's house? So some people say, I'm at my in-laws, I'm at my parents, I'll tell them, I don't eat this milk, it's OUD, I eat only Chalav Yisrael. But the truth is that who said they're allowed to pain and cause their parents to go the extra mile and go search for Chalav Yisrael milk when really they could drink that milk? And the same is true for other things. Avram tells Sarai, he says, in this scenario, in this situation, we'll go back. We'll revert to the Noahide laws.
So that brings me to a halakha question. I know, whenever you accept a stringency upon yourself, and unless you make it a prior condition that you're not making it a minhag, once you do it three times, it's you have to keep doing it. Are you allowed then to stop doing it temporarily for a great need without having to get it annulled or something?
I can't answer that in 2 seconds.
I wondered if Abraham and Sarah were
In general, you should make a condition on whatever you're doing. You're doing it as a stringency, and you'll do it when you can and when it works. That's the way you should in general do stringencies. Do we say that applies to every stringency? Let's leave that. Yeah. Okay, so Paro calls Avram, he says, what's going on? Kicks Avram away. Avram's wealthy. How did Avram get all this wealth? Why is it that Avram does not want wealth from the king of Sodom, and he's willing to accept from Paro? So that we'll discuss when we get there. Lot also gets wealthy. Our sages tell us, we learn from here, you stick to someone that's going up, then you'll also go up. Avram tries to avoid a fight. There's a girsa here in Rashi that we don't seem to have. Avram tells Lot, he says, it's not nice that all our neighbors will see two brothers fighting. That's something we should remember. Sometimes people, for inheritance or other things, they say, hey, what's mine is mine. And Avram says, no, I'll forgo things. Avram tells him, you choose which way you want to go. And Lot says, fine, and he does choose. Lot looks out, and he sees the people of Sodom and Amorah sinning. We will expand on the sins of Sodom and Amorah next week, but we'll just give an example. There's a medrash that says that in Sodom and Amorah, when a person would become poor, so the way it worked was, they'd say, fine, we'll give you charity, no problem. Each person would give him a coin. And then they'd write his name on the public records. And the law was that no one would sell him anything. So now he had money, couldn't buy food. And the man would either have to leave town or die of starvation. And usually they couldn't really leave. They'd end up starving to death. And then each person would come back and take his coin. So they had laws as to how to be cruel. Their cruelty was written into law. Why they couldn't leave is because the Sodom and Amorah had so much wealth and so much money that they wanted to ensure that people couldn't come in. They had guards around the city. If someone wanted to come into the city, he'd try to cross the bridge. So when he'd finish crossing the bridge, they tell him, he'd come to the bridge, they tell him, you have to pay toll. It's how much is the toll? They tell him $1,000. Say, $1,000 to cross the bridge? They say, yeah, you want to enter our city? You have to pay that money. So he says, fine. He swims or he builds a boat and crosses through the river. He comes out on the bank and they stop him. They say, he says, what do you want? They say, pay tax. He says, what do I have to pay tax? You used our river, you crossed our river. Now you have to pay $2,000. Twice. They'd make him pay double. What kind of laws are these? These are laws with the intent of being cruel. The idea was, we don't want people to come to our town. We have wealth, we have abundance, we don't want anyone else to take it. What? How did? Lot didn't come in. Lot was wealthy, and he expanded his flocks and his mass of tents until they reached the edge of the city of Sodom. He didn't really enter the city of Sodom. Eventually, the people of Sodom saw how wealthy he was. They wanted him as one of them, and they appointed him. They gave him a position as a judge. But Lot was very attracted to the znus that was going on in Sodom and what was going on there, the wealth. Znut is an improper relationship. It's satiation of a different need. Nah. So Lot, so the people of Sodom are sinful, and that still doesn't cause Lot to leave them. Our sages tell us that a person should always try to be in a neighborhood where he has good people around him, because we're all affected, whether we like it or not, by the people that are around us. After Lot leaves, yeah.
I think India and Brazil used to have evil policies. We said similar policies, where we want to keep all the money and we're going to make our own products, we're not going to buy things from outside. And it turns out that their economy has faltered because of it. Interestingly, that policy is not a good economic policy. And in this case, also about like moral policy.
That's like saying capitalism is better than socialism.
Not after they do with each other. Brazil
exactly.
And India.
Exactly.
Capitalist.
There's no answer.
Okay.
No, that's not true. And they have to guys.
Shem tells Avram, look around. Everything you see, north, south, east, west, I'm giving you and your offsprings forever. And here, there's a halachic relevance to this promise. Because God, on the one hand, tells him, I'm going to give it to you. On the other hand, God says, I'm going to give it to your offspring. So who got it? The Gemara discusses, when the Jews entered the land of Israel, Who owned the land of Israel? Did we acquire it when we entered it, or did Avram acquire it at this point? And the halachic relevance would be if the non-Jews did things in the land, served certain things, made certain trees their idols. Do we say those trees became forbidden, or do we say those trees didn't belong to them? If someone comes and bows down to my tree, does he make my tree forbidden? It's my tree. He can't make my tree forbidden just because he wants to make it into an idol. Well, how do we treat the land of Israel during this period? This period when God says, I'm going to give it to you and your offsprings. So this is a discussion in the Gemara. Yeah?
Didn't he acquire it prior to going to Egypt when he walked?
Oh, so God said walk, and you're walking through the land is because I will give it to you, seeming like he will get it. On the other hand, we also say that non-Jews did have certain possession of the land. Let's say a non-Jew said, I want to make peace with the Jewish people. Let's leave that.
And also, it seems like the life of Abraham was symbolic of almost everything that happens in the future.
That we discussed last night. He said that, Ma'asavot Siman Levanim, and we gave a lot of examples. Yeah, that's true. The Torah tells us of a war, yeah.
According to the opinion that Avram was given, it's given to Avram. We live in Syria or Lebanon, whatever, and we own a house. Do we get the same scarf as what we're living in Israel?
Well, we find that God describes the borders of the land that He's going to give Avram as being far more encompassing than the borders we later had. And God's giving the land to Avram does not automatically give the land the holiness that the land did get when the Jewish people conquered it. Meaning there are two questions here. There's a question of ownership and there's a question of holiness. You're assuming that the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel is to live in the land that was given to Avram. I'm not sure that's the case. I think that the mitzvah is to live in the land of Eretz Yisrael, the land of the Jewish people, which would be the land that was made holy by Yeshua, and maybe not even Yeshua, maybe it goes to the time of the second temple. That's a separate discussion about the holiness of the land and the mitzvah of settling the land.
I remember you said before that most
states of Israel and
most
West Bank, is it?
Most post-Kim hold that Egypt, no, Sinai, is considered part of Israel. Did Yeshua conquer the Sinai? Or is it part of the times of the Second Temple?
Second Temple, not. If I'm not mistaken, Yeshua, yeah. I don't remember offhand. If I'm not mistaken, Yeshua, yeah, Second Temple, not.
So according to that opinion.
But what I'm telling you could be way off. I have to look at it.
I remember reading Rambam that said that like any land we conquer becomes part of Eretz Israel, like wherever that land
is. It's such a concept, but you guys are going off on branches which if we conquered all of the land of Israel and we have a court, after we've made all of the land of Israel holy, then lands that are conquered based upon the direction and guidance of a king and a court can also have the holiness of the land of Israel. That is true. Yes, just like Nari wanted something. Yosef. Yeah.
Does Karen Jordan have the steps in the same? Was the same question. Is that the steps of Eretz Israel? The west side? The east side?
The east side, you mean? I don't know.
My question is, because we see with Moshe Rabbeinu when we were discussing his death, he was on that east side of the Jordan, and he hadn't entered Eretz Israel. And how is it that the decision of certain people to stay on that east side of the Jordan Valley because of their of the grass of we say for the sheep that they had the flocks, that instill made it as Israel or did it?
With regard to certain things we treated as Eretz Israel.
That
But whether they were in performance of the mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, I don't know. Yeah, Benjamin, sorry, yeah.
What were we talking about? Okay, oh yes, I read that that the Jerusalem was holy even like for like before Abraham was born, because Shem was like taking care of the land and being like a priest in the land for a long time prior to Abraham probably even being born, and because he would, so that when that's what I read. What do you think about that?
Let's wait. If we get to it, then tonight, I hope to still learn Pirkei Rabbi Elazar. I meant to start with that.
I think
we'll discuss Jerusalem as well.
The land of Israel has always been holy ever since even the when Noah cursed Ham. He said that Shem's people were going to take over Canaan's land, stuff like that.
There is an aspect where we say the land of Israel and Jerusalem and the Temple Mount have intrinsic holiness. There's an aspect where we say they have a certain holiness that stems from the Jewish people. On the one hand, we find that God created Adam from the Temple Mount, and the land of Israel has holiness. On the other hand, we find that the Midrash says that the land gained holiness, and that prophets could only prophesy there after the Jewish people entered the land of Israel. So we see it gained holiness. Gained holiness with regard to trumas and maizers and other things. The holiness of the land, of the fruits of the land.
Okay, I'll get off that. But as far as like when I remember when David was anointed as king, it's kind of
remember that.
Like when did he become king? Like there's a time when Hashem anointed him as king through the prophet.
Why is that now?
Because it has to do with the
So let's. I hope we'll still have a session where
when Hashem promised Abraham, this is going to be the land of descendants. It's when Hashem says it. It's. But it takes time for things to actually come about, and then it comes back. So. I just relating it to like King David in that way, where he's anointed as king by Hashem, but it just takes time for it to come about.
Okay, yeah, that's true. Yeah. So we have a war. We have five kings who are miserable. That's this empire, Sodom, Amora, this area which is very fertile, and it's been overtaken by some other wicked kings. And the main one is Nimrod, who had it under his jurisdiction. And when they rebel, so he gathers the other kings to join him, and they go to war. So we have 13 years of rebellion, and in the 14th year we have a war. And during this war, Nimrod and his men, they destroy giants. How exactly you defeat giants, I don't know. And they destroy these five kings, and they take them captive, and they start leaving. And they have Lot. And the Palit, one guy who escapes from the war, he comes to Avram and he tells him what happened and that Lot has been captured. And our sages say this Palit was Og, the giant. Og, the king of Bashan, Og made it out. And Og,
he
made it out of the war, he escaped.
Because Og is supposed to have, like, he survived the flood. So
Because the giant had relationships with his wife,
He didn't want everyone to think it was.
Well, yeah, that I never heard. Okay.
Where did that major?
Shkach. Learn new things every day.
So
yeah, okay.
Sons, but did they
let's not go to
the Shem and Og. Through like.
Okay. So, Og wants to marry Sarai. He knows Avram has this gorgeous wife named Sarai. And he wants her for himself. So he figures if he could get Avram to go on this suicidal mission against these four awesome kings, Avram will get killed. And then Og will walk onto the scene and get Sarai for himself. Now, it's interesting that among our sages, it seems unclear as to why Avram went to war. It seems like it was very pious. He went to save his relative. But it seems like he didn't get a promise from God that he'd be successful. Now he's taking on four kings and he's not even a king. He's taking on four kings and their armies. He doesn't even have an army.
He has Eliezer.
Even if Eliezer's a giant, they just killed all these giants. He's going with 318 men to war. And it seems that some there have shown him learn that this was suicidal. That Avram said, I'm going to do my best. He didn't have a promise anywhere that he'd be successful. So the Pasuk stresses that he used ambush tactics. He attacked them from two fronts. He made it seem like there were great armies attacking. He attacked at night. Great. Bottom line, he's with 318 men against four kings and their men. So he had a miracle. He won.
Did they just kill everybody while they're sleeping because they're all drunk? Four kings and their soldiers?
I don't know of such a thing.
They're all sleeping and drunk and they just went and killed everybody.
Okay. There was a chase here. It says he chased them. Okay. It's the night of Pesach and Avram's chasing them. And Avram says to God, I want half the merits tonight. The other half saved for the Jewish people on this night. So on this night, Avram gives chase and he's successful. He has a miraculous success against these kings, and the amount of ground that he covers in one night is also miraculous. He conquers basically the whole land of Israel. He chases them throughout and chases them out of the land of Israel. And when he comes back, so he has all of the wealth of these five kings that had been conquered, Sodom and Amorah and everything, and all of their servants. And the servants, they say to him, we don't want to go back. So Avram doesn't give them back. The king of Sodom tells him, I want my men, you take the wealth. And Avram says, fine, you can have the men, but you're not getting the servants back. The servants, they stay by me. They want to serve God. I can't be kind to you at someone else's expense. I could be nice to you at no one's expense, but not at the servants' expense. They don't want to come back under your rule. They don't want to be servants under idol worshippers. They want to stay by me. So they're going to stay by me. The king of Sodom tells him, you take the wealth and give me my people back. And Avram tells him, I don't want anything from you. So what happened by Paro? How come over there Avram got wealth? So one understanding is that when Paro gave him the wealth, so Paro wanted the honor of having given Avram wealth. The Gemara says there exists a concept in Halacha that there's an Adam Chashuv, an important person. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, a person once came to him and said, I want to give you a phone. So he said, why would I want it? So he said, you know how many people could call you and ask you questions? So he said, why would I want it? So he said, yeah, but still, in today's world, it'll help your wife, and people do need to reach you sometimes. So the guy convinced him finally. Why did he want to give him the phone? He wanted to be able to say, I gave Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach the phone. He's using my phone to answer the whole world's questions. When you have an important person So sometimes you give them a gift, that's a sign of honor. When Bill Clinton came to Israel, so there was a famous comedian here in Israel whose son was very sick. And the Make-A-Wish Foundation asked him what he wanted, and he said, I want Bill Clinton to visit me in hospital. So Bill Clinton came. And when he visited him in the hospital, so this kid gave him, this kid's name was Ari something, I don't remember. He gave him a t-shirt, he gave him a gift, he gave Clinton a gift, and on the t-shirt it said, I met Ari so-and-so. So Bill Clinton, like that, he said, wait, I'm going to wear this and you'll see. You keep tabs on me and I'm telling you, I'm going to wear it. And one time when he was jogging, so he wore this t-shirt that said a big sign, I met Ari so-and-so. And all the helicopters took a picture of Bill Clinton jogging with this t-shirt, I met Ari so-and-so. So then he came to visit Israel a second time, and again this kid was unfortunately in the hospital, and he asked for Bill Clinton to visit him, and again Bill Clinton came in and he said thanks, and he gave him another gift. This time was a t-shirt that said, I met Ari so-and-so twice. So sometimes it's an honor when someone else accepts your gift, it's an honor. Paro recognized who Avraham was. Paro said, I want to give you money. I want to be able to say you have my money. Sodom and Amorah were people who were sinful, who were hateful. These were people who Avram didn't want a penny of theirs in his house. If the king of Sodom was willing to give him money, it was only because he had an in. It was only because he had something to gain from him. It wasn't because he recognized what it was to have Avram standing before him, to have the servant of God before him. That's one understanding that's offered, but there are others. We mentioned others yesterday, but that's another one. So the king of Sodom is told by Avram, he says, Im michut v'atzochnal. What does Avram tell him? Let's read the whole sentence.
I have a question about that previous money thing, the thing you just talked about.
Okay.
So you say Sodom is evil and Avram doesn't want to be kept likable. Pharaoh wasn't a paragon of righteousness either, he's living in this licentious land, he takes Sarah. So, I mean,
there's a story behind that.
I mean, Pharaoh isn't this paragon himself, so...
But he was on a higher level. He wasn't on the level of stone. There was a difference. We're not saying he was the most pious person. So, Avram says, Harimoti Adi, I raise my hand, El Hashem Kel Elyon, to Hashem, who is the God who is above everything, Konei Shamayim Va'aretz, who has fashioned, created the heavens and the earth, knows that the word Kone we're accustomed to meaning acquire, but it could also mean to create, to make, to bring in, to fashion, to make in a certain way, like Kinyan. Avram says, Im michut v'atzochnal, from a string to a shoelace, v'imekach mikol ha'shalach, let I take anything from you. What was Avram saying? So the simple understanding was he's saying, I don't want anything. I don't want a shoelace. I don't want a string. I don't want anything. And our sages say that Avram merited to get two mitzvahs, the mitzvah of tefillin, which is made he got the mitzvah in michut, he said, from a string. For that he got the mitzvah of tzitzis. That's ochnal till the shoelace, which in their times the shoes, the sandals were made of hide. So he got in that merit the mitzvah of tefillin. His offspring's got that merit. What was Avram saying? So, one understanding here is that Avram was saying, I raised my hand to God above, who created everything, and allowed me to win this war. And I say, God, I want to gain nothing from this war. I don't want a shoelace. I don't want a string. I don't want to gain anything. I want to serve you out of love. It's true. I stood up to the test. I had a test. My nephew was kidnapped. I had to go to war to save him. And I stood up to the test. I don't want to get anything out of it. I want to serve you out of love. This is Avram. Avram serves Hashem me'ahava out of love. And then he turns to the king of Sodom and he says, and you? I'm not going to take anything from you. I'm not going to take anything from you. If I'm not willing to accept from God what's rightfully mine, I won this war, certainly I'm not going to take from you. At this point, I think we're going to call it on. Avram tells him, there's one thing I do want. There were people who stayed and watched over the goods. There are people who stayed on Er Eshkol Mamre, my compadres. They were watching the home front. They have to get their pay. And our Chazal say that Avram here instituted something which remained till David HaMelech, and from then on David instituted it forever. And that is that kechelek ha'yotzel ha'minchama, just like the person who went out to war gets part of the booty, so to the person who stayed back and watched the home front gets part of the booty. The person can't say, well, I risked my life. You could have only went out to risk your life if someone else were staying home watching the goods. And the same thing is true, by the way, I think it's a simple correlation, in one's home. Very often people, when girls talk to me about shiduchim, so I say we do this, we do that, and they ask me, what, you're an organization, what's the we? So I say, me and my wife. So I say, she deals with this too? I say, yeah. Now it's true that 98% I do, but I don't view it as me, because I couldn't do anything I'm doing if not for the fact that you were taking care of the kids, you were taking care of everything at home. So I automatically say we. I don't even think about it, because I really think it's we. There's nothing that I do that's me. I couldn't do anything that I'm doing. I couldn't be here tonight if not for the fact that my wife is at home watching the kids preparing the Shabbos. So it's we. We're partners. You can't say, yeah, I'm the one learning Torah. No, we're the ones learning Torah. I can't take the credit. I could only be here tonight because someone else is there at home doing the other parts. And Avram says, I could only go out to war if they were at home watching everything else. So they get an equal portion. Rabbi Feinstein writes that in learning Torah, the division between a husband and his wife is different than the division if you give someone money in order to learn Torah. You say, I want you to learn Torah. I want to have a portion of your Torah. I'll give you X amount of money each month. So then you divide the section in the world to come one way. But between a husband and wife, Rabbi Feinstein writes, it's one unit. It's not that she's giving him the money so he could learn Torah. No, they're one unit. She's doing her part of the work and he's doing his part of the work. And then they divide what they get at the end of the day. After the war, so Avram had just had a great miracle. He won 4 awesome kings. And God tells him, Avram, don't fear. You still have a lot of merits. And here we see something basic when it comes to tzaddikim. Tzaddik values everything that God gives him, and he doesn't look at himself as something special. He says, I'm doing my job. I'm just doing my job. So when a tzaddik gets such a great reward that he's so successful at war, he looks up to Hashem and he says, what's left after you did such a great thing for me? Notice that we're all the exact opposite. When we'll be tzaddikim, we'll be that way. Ordinarily, we think, God, you know what I did for you today? We could all enumerate it. I got up on time. Even if I didn't get up on time, right? I ran out to daven. I make all the blessings.
Oh, for sure.
I speak nicely to the guy next to me. Look at how much I do. I learned Torah. I stay at class till 12:30. Other guys are falling like flies and I'm sitting here learning. Look at what a tzaddik I am. We could all enumerate our merits. But if we were with the correct perspective, we'd recognize I'm just doing my job. If at best I'm doing my job. When the baby's crying, so my father-in-law always says, he's just doing his job. I wish I could say the same. He's just doing his job. That's his job now, to cry, to fill diapers, to sleep. He's doing his job. I wish I could say I was doing my job. So God tells Avram, do not fear. You still have a lot of reward. Avram asks God, what do you give me? I have no kids. Why is Avram asking this? God told him at the beginning of the parasha, I'll make you into a great nation. So tzaddikim are always fearful. Even when God promises them good things, they're always scared. Maybe when God promised me the good thing, it was on the condition that I remain on the high level, that I have more merits. Maybe God meant, if you pray for it, if you do your best for it, you will get this. Just because God gave him the promise, Avram doesn't feel like for sure I will have kids. And that's why Avram turns to God and he says, what will you give me? I don't have anything. And Avram feels like he's hit this ripe old age of 99 or however old he was at this time. And if he hasn't gotten it by now and his wife is 89, then it's not going to happen. And even though God had told him that he'd be a great nation, he feels like he didn't make it. It's interesting to note, there's a famous riddle. We encounter many times through these parashios Avram's faithful servant Eliezer. He's the one that Avram sends out to search for a wife for Yitzchak. He's the one that joins Avram to war. We encounter him all the time. He's the one that goes with Avram to the Akedah. We're going to encounter him throughout the Parashios. How often does his name show up throughout the Parashios?
Once.
Once. Very good. Shows up here. Avram tells God, this is the only time it shows up. Every other time, our sages tell us on tradition that he's the one that the Torah is talking about, but he doesn't show up by name any other time but here. We have the whole conversation. Eliezer goes out, meets up with Lavan, meets up with Besuel, does the whole deal of bringing back Rivka, speaks to Rivka. The Torah records this whole story in Parashas Chayesara. It's always referred to as Ha'eved, the servant. He's not mentioned by name. This is the only time when Avram says, Damascus Eliezer, my servant Eliezer from Damascus, he's going to inherit me. And God says, no, he won't. God tells him, you will have a child. And then God takes him out and says, look down upon the stars. Can you count them? That's how many children you will have. Look down upon the stars. God says, Avram, I know you. You've been looking into the stars, and you see in the stars you're not going to have kids. You see in the stars that Sarai can't have kids. It was worse than that. Our sages say that Avram had a physical problem. He could not bring kids to the world. Avram had a problem, the Gemara says.
Sarai
also had a problem.
Wait. Hagar, Ishmael.
Right, good point.
Okay.
You're with it, very good. So the Gemara records that Avram had this problem. We see that God wanted him to overcome the problem, but God over here tells Avram, he says,
but it's until he changes his name that everything's solved. And when everything's solved, doesn't he have kids after his name is changed? Does Ishmael born after his name is Avram? Because what I'm told is that in the astrology books, they went by his name. And then once his name was changed, in the astrology, the stars was all different. And the reason why he was bummed out was
bummed out.
So the
when he did the astrology stuff, he went by his name, his third name. But Hashem knew, Allah, that he was going to give him a new name afterwards.
So that's what the Midrash says, right? Avram had Yishmael when he was still Avram. He was named Avraham when he was 99. Okay. So God tells him, "Vayetzeto achutza." God took him out. God said, "Go out, leave this astrology. You look in the stars and you decide what's going to be." It's interesting. There was a famous Rav here in Israel named Rav Haitan. And when he was young, learning America's Arav, he went with a group of guys, and they got dressed up. They heard there was a famous astrologer, a guy who could tell people their fortune coming to Jerusalem. So they got dressed up, and they went to him. And they walked into him, and I think the way the story goes, I'm not sure I remember it correctly. There are two stories, I'm not sure which one was with him. I think the way the story goes that he started telling them what would be, And then some point, I don't know if he figured out or they told him that they were yeshiva guys. They said, oh, you guys, you're Jewish and you're learning, and this has nothing to do with you. None of what I'm telling you is going to work. You guys, this isn't relevant. That's what Hashem told Avram. He said, Avram, you can't look at the stars and decide this is what's going to be. You don't know what's going to be. You see in the stars, you think you won't have kids. It's not true. You can have kids. The Medrash, there is a Medrash which says what Binyamin said, that God told him that in the stars is written that Avram cannot have kids, but Avraham could have kids. And when God changed his name, he was able to have kids. There's also that Medrash. But God told him, get out of this. There's a machlokas among Midrashim. There's a Medrash that says, Ein mazal Yisrael. The Jews have no mazal. Nothing that says in the stars really can affect what's happening with the Jews. It doesn't apply to Jews. That's one Medrash. And then there's another medrash that says that Jews can overcome their mazel, which seems to indicate that we do have a mazel. The stars do decide what's going to be. The constellations do cause what's going to happen. But a Jew was given the potential to change that, to overcome that.
The question is,
He has free will. We know that the stars don't dictate exactly what will be. Even the stars, they say that the leader of the Jews will fall in the water. So they thought that it meant if you throw all the males into the water, that's how you'll get rid of the leader of the Jews. The second that his mother puts his casket in the water, the stargazers tell Pharaoh, the leader of the Jews just hit the water. You're okay. That's it. The danger is over. You see it, they don't know exactly what's going on. The Pasuk says they see and they don't know exactly what's going to be. I don't know if the guiding aspect. There are certain things where the stars can dictate. But today, I don't think there's anyone that really knows how to read the stars.
But I'm talking about the concept of free will for the non-Jew. If they're all left-shaped, they cannot...
So we just said it's not accurately shaped.
But even vaguely on the general aspects, how...
So the general aspects, did anyone ask you whether you'd be strong or weak? Tall or short? Here we're talking about things that are more vague, and we see that they could change. You can decide how they'll be. A person is born under a red star, he will spill blood. So he could be a mohel, he could be a shochet, he could be a murderer. So that means that he doesn't have free will. It means that he's going to have certain inclination. And if a person is born with an inclination, he's hyper. So he could be a good businessman. He could also be a troublemaker and illiterate. He could do a lot of things. The question is, what's he going to do with the challenge that God gave him? Every challenge can be turned into opportunity. The question is, what do you do with it?
Yeah.
There's the famous story about the guy who lost his job because he couldn't sign his name. And one day they told him, yeah, you have to sign your name. So he said, I can't. I don't know how to read or write. So they said, you don't know how to read or write? You can't continue here. So he was working at some bank. So he walked out of the bank, all depressed. He knew he had to come home and he doesn't have a paycheck. What's he going to tell his wife? So he's walking around depressed and he needs a cigar. He needs a cigarette. He's got to get a cigarette. He looks around. There's no store. He can't buy. He's looking. There's no grocery around. He's walking through Manhattan looking, where can he get his cigarette? He says, this is ridiculous. At this time in my life, I need a cigarette. There's no cigarettes to buy. So he decides he's opening one of those small booths that sell cigarettes. And this was the person who started all those small booths that you have all around Manhattan selling cigarettes and newspapers and candy. And he became a multimillionaire. He became a multimillionaire because he lost his job because he couldn't sign his name, because he couldn't read or write. That's like the guy who was working at an insurance agency. One day they told him, we have to send you all the information via email. And he said, I don't have email. So I said, well, you have to get email or you can't continue. And he said, I can't get email. I don't have internet. So to make a long story short, they fired him. They said, you're not with the times. We can't keep with you. And he didn't know what to do. So he was walking and he saw tomatoes for sale. So he bought a crate of tomatoes and he went to the city and sold the tomatoes at a much higher price. He said, hey, this is good money. So he bought another crate of tomatoes and soon he had to buy a truck and soon he had a fleet of trucks. And then finally, to make a long story short, he and his kids were multimillionaires. And then one day he said, hey, you know, I have to get insurance for myself, my family. So he calls the insurance agent and the agent tells him, can I email you the rates and stuff? So he says, I don't have an email. So he tells him, man, with your business doesn't have email? Do you know what kind of money you'd be making if you had email? So he says, no, sir. If I had email, I'd still be making $4.95. You can't say that things are signed in the heavens. We don't know. Every situation can be turned into an opportunity. The question is what we do with it. Avram was in a situation where he couldn't have kids. That was his test. God tells him that doesn't mean your fate is sealed. You will have children. Avram doesn't ask for a sign. God promises him he will have kids like the stars. Later on, God tells him he will have kids like the earth, like the sand, like the dust. And our sages say that this is exemplary of the Jewish people. When we go up, we're like the stars. We shoot up to the top. And when we go down, everyone steps on us. Says the Rambam, even when everyone steps on us. What's the ground? You spend your whole life stepping on it. And yet at the end, you're buried in it. And who's on top? The ground. The Rambam says that's the way the Jewish people are. Throughout what we see, everyone's stepping on them. But at the end, they will overcome. Just as the ground at the end overcomes the human. Yeah?
So it describes the Jews as the stars and also the sun?
Over here, the stars. Later in the parasha, the sand. Yeah. So, he had faith in God. He considered God's promise as tzedakah, as though God was doing him a favor. He didn't think, oh, I deserve this. God promised me I'm such a good person. He said, no, wow. God's doing me such a favor. He's giving me a promise to have kids. God tells him, I wanted to give you this land as an inheritance. And he tells God, well, I want a sign. How will I know that I'll inherit it? Our sages say that what Avram was asking is, what will be if my kids sin? It's good you're promising me a land. You're promising me my children will become a great nation. What happens when they sin? Avram was wise enough to know that the tendency of man is to have faults. So God tells Avram, take for me 3 goats, 3 calves, 3 rams, and 2 young birds, and then sacrifice them. And this was a sign. God said, I will give your children the ability to bring sacrifices to atone for their sins. And then the Midrash says, Avram said to God, that's good when they're not exiled, when they have a Beis HaMikdash. What happens when the temple is destroyed? What happens when they can't bring sacrifices? And God said, when they don't have a temple, if they read the parasha describing my commandment to bring the sacrifices, I'll consider it as though they brought a sacrifice. They don't have to go to the temple. They don't have a temple. And this shows us the importance of what the Sfardim do and what Ashkenazim should also do. Before Shachris, before Mincha, they read the parasha of the Tamid. Right? There's the parasha in the Torah that describes the sacrifice that should be brought every morning and every afternoon in the temple. Well, every person should really read that. Now, you guys, I don't know, your Shmona Esrei takes you 45 minutes as it is. You don't need the extra burden. But in the long run, you should know this is what you should be aspiring to. Eventually, when you're Shmona Esrei, you could do all Shmona Esrei in 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 7 minutes. When you know it very, very well and you could have the proper intent the way Ari wants us to, and with the intent, say it in 7 minutes flat, so then it's a good idea to start mentioning this as well.
Well,
everyone should do
it. How early you start before this move, right?
Well, however it works for you.
I'm still in Kida.
Fine. Slowly everyone starts there. Huh? I'm with you.
That the Amida should be said in Hebrew. And then I heard another opinion that says it can be said in any language. And then I heard another opinion that said that sound of Amida should be said in Hebrew. And then Chazar Ashat should be said, or should can be said in any language so the congregation can understand it.
So let's deal with that afterwards. You're right, it's Thursday night. But we still a little bit of say there.
It's like all night here.
Yeah. God tells Avram, your offsprings are going to be 400 years in a foreign land, and ultimately I will judge the nation. And this is a sign not only for the people of Mitzrayim, but also for all the nations that will put us in servitude in the time to come. God tells him that he will be buried in peace. And that's a good promise for Avram. A person should always want to have peace. Even though we say that it's good to stand up to tests, it's also good to have peace. That's a promise. That's a gift that Avram is given, that he will die in peace. The fourth generation will come here because the Emori, the people, have not sinned enough to deserve being kicked out of the land. Here God shows us that as much as he loves the Jewish people and he wants to give us the land, God is fair. God says when they sin the amount that they deserve to be kicked out, then they'll be kicked out and you'll get the land. Yeah. They were practically in Egypt 210, but we discussed this. You weren't here last night, right?
No, I wasn't here last night.
So we did a whole thing on this. Yeah.
1948, Abraham was born, right?
Right.
And that's the beginning of everything.
Right.
The nation of Israel is 1948 nowadays.
Okay.
So what? From the time that they could have made brought the redemption, with Moshe Rabbeinu as the Mashiach? How many more years was that? Do you know what I'm saying?
Nope.
But I keep
answering
your question. So okay, so 230 years after that was 40 years. So be 20 times 240, right? No, wait, no, we've been right away. 210 years.
Not following your numbers.
Okay, so Abraham was born in 1948, right?
Right.
210, and then this would be like 90. But
I'll summarize the things, and then if you still have a question, tell me, okay?
Okay.
Avram was born 1948.
No, because
2048 was when Yitzchak was born. 2448, the Jewish people left Egypt. 2448 is 400 years after 2048, which is the year Yitzchak was born. The number 400 years is counting from the day Yitzchak was born, because God said, your children will be in a land that is not theirs, and Yitzchak was in a land that was not his. He was in the land of Canaan that was not his. So God, as God always does when he gives a decree, God built in multiple understandings, and here God was kind to us in that he chose to go with the understanding that is most lenient to us, or very lenient to us. So in the year 2048, Avram had the prophecy, Avram had Yitzhak. In the year 2047, God told him, I want you to know your children will be in a land that's not theirs, and they'll be enslaved for 400 years. You with me till here? Well, that's not accurate what I just said, I'm sorry. That was the year, no, it wasn't the year 2047 when he had that prophecy, but rather it was the year 2035 or 34. Yeah. There are different understandings as to why the Jewish people had to go to exile. One understanding says that it was because Avram said, give me a sign that I'll inherit the land. How do I know that I will? We saw the story of Hagar, and we discussed the meaning of the name Hagar. Hagar has the son Yishmael, that in his time the God will hear the Jewish people call out in pain and affliction from Yishmael. Yishmael comes from the fact that God will hear our cry when the people of Yishmael afflict us. Avram is 99 years old, and God tells him, I want you to be whole, I want you to be complete, I want you to be tamim, I am making a treaty between me and you. And that treaty is that you will remove the foreskin, you will become circumcised, and when you circumcise yourself, that is when you are whole. A person who is uncircumcised is not whole. The potential for a person to come close to Hashem is contingent upon removing that foreskin. So long as Avram had the foreskin, whenever he'd get prophecy, he'd fall flat on his face, he couldn't handle it. The second the foreskin was removed, Avram was able to have prophecy and not be knocked out by it. God tells him, this is the treaty, based upon this you will inherit the land of Israel. This is the treaty between me and you and your offsprings from now on. Some of the reasons for Bris Milah that we could understand is that it weakens the desire, it allows a person to contain himself much better. When a person has a Bris Milah, so this is a sign that unites all of the Jewish people, it is something which is difficult to perform, so that if someone says, I want to become a Jew, so we tell them, okay, do this. Well, that's an area that's very sensitive, and only a person that really means it, that he wants to become Jewish, is going to allow himself to be circumcised. A few of the reasons why God said that the circumcision should be done at 8 days old, so one of the reasons is that it's easier for parents. When a child is just born, 8 days old, they're not as attached to him. When the kid is 2 years old, it's much more difficult to allow such a procedure to be done to the child. Oh, so that's why the Torah said a person should do it when the child is 8 days old. Another understanding, another reason why is because at 8 days old, the skin is still very soft, and it's far less painful and far easier to perform circumcision. It's not a major operation, which happens to be true medically today. They recognize that as well.
Daniel said something about how, like, there's like 120% chance, whatever that meant, of the highest percentage hospitals in the area of clotting properly, the blood clotting properly.
Today they discovered that medically, right, the best time for a child to have a circumcision is on the eighth day. Yeah. So this is part of what the Rambam writes. If you want, you can see the Rambam more in Nebuchim. Other Rishonim say not that way. They say that it is medically better to be circumcised today. We know that circumcision helps prevent AIDS and other diseases from being transmitted. Over 50% protection. The numbers today statistically are 65% and up. Not that I would recommend promiscuity aside from the fact that it's prohibited, but also safety-wise. I mean, A, it's prohibited, the Torah prohibits it, but also don't count on the bris milah, it's not 100%. But that's why today many hospitals also perform bris milah. It's worthwhile to remember that the Rambam told us that doing a bris milah will cause one to have a certain element of less sensitivity and less pleasure, and this allows a person to contain himself better. Today people think they discovered the wheel and they say, oh, if you do bris milah, so then there's less pleasure. Well, very good. 1,000 years ago the Rambam said that. Fine, that's a little under 1,000 years. Avram is renamed as Avraham. Sarai is renamed as Sarah. Avraham means Avlo Kol Olam, is father to the world. And we discussed the letter of the Rambam to Rabbi Ovadia the Ger, that every Ger is considered a direct son of Avram. As we say, a Ger is called Ben Avraham. And the Rambam says that we are connected to Avram as part of the Jewish people, but the Ger has a direct connection. He's considered like Avram's son. That's why the Rambam writes that Gerim can say Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu and Shmon Esrei, etc., as that opinion is expressed in the Mishnah in Bikurim. Avram is told he will have a son. He will name him Yitzchak, as Avram laughed out of joy when he was told that he will have a son. And God blesses Yishmael that he will have 12 great leaders, that as Avram had asked, that Yishmael should also stand before Hashem. But God says the chosen one is going to be Yitzchak. The one who I keep my treaty with is Yitzchak, who will be born a year from now, which makes the Brit, this vision that Avram had on Leil Pesach. As we know, Yitzchak was also born by Pesach night. And Avram does a bris milah for himself, for Yishmael, and all his family. Avram is 99 at the time that he does a bris milah. Yishmael is 13 years old. In the middle of the day, Avram asks his friends, what should I do? If I do bris milah, I have so many enemies, all these kings that I fought, maybe they'll attack. What should I do? And some of them tell him, Avram, if you do bris milah, the world's going to think you're a lunatic. Who does such a thing? If you do that, you're going to lose all effect, all impact. No one's going to respect you anymore. They're going to look at you, oh, that's the weirdo. He's circumcised. You ever hear someone who does that to his whole family? And Avram takes counsel with his good friend Mamre. And Mamre says, Avram, God told you to do it. Do it. Do it in broad daylight, the middle of the day. You do that, bris milah. And Avram listens to him. And on that note, we will end our parsha and start next week's parsha, God willing. Mamre gets in merit for giving that piece of advice. Mamre gets the reward that God... Mamre is one of the three good friends that Avram had. Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre are the three good friends. And what? They helped him in the war. And that's why Mamre will merit that next parsha begins, that God appears to Avram in Mamre's territory. I don't know. Yeah, Ziggy, you want some? Okay.